Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. We here at the Guerrilla Media Network do welcome your calls, and the number is 218-862-9829. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and my special guest today is Andrew Johnson from the United Kingdom, and he lives in the UK. I'm sure he was born, I'm guessing, but sounds to me like he was born in the UK. And he's worked in software development and education for some 25 years, developing software used in telecom and process control PCs and database systems. So, hey, he's an IT guy. He's probably somebody I should talk to more often to help me out. And back in 2003, when he got broadband internet access, he began to research what he terms alternate knowledge topics. Yeah. I think that's a very nice way to put it, including his research into 9/11, anomalies on Mars, or at least the reports we get from NASA about Mars, the Apollo missions, chemtrails, and crop circles. And he's had association with Dr. Judy Wood's work and mine, and what he terms conclusive research into some of the events of 9/11. And he's posted lots of useful things on his website, checktheevidence.com. And then he's put out a free ebook called 9/11, Finding the Truth. And you will find amusement in there, as well as solid information about what's going on, much of it behind the scenes in the whole 9/11 effort. So welcome to the Reynolds Reveal, Andrew.
Thank you, Morgan. Thanks for that excellent introduction.
And we want to talk about maybe five or six of these issues that you've delved into. The first one I know quite a bit about, but you've got some news on 9/11, one of them being to tell us about Richard D. Hall's recent tour. And of course, in episode six, I had both of you on. So what can you tell us about Richard's latest enterprise there on 9/11?
Yeah, well, Richard, you know, we discussed some of the things he was going to talk about on his tour, and basically Richard did, you know, you can go onto his website and find the details, but he did about, I think, eight or nine dates over a period of about 2 weeks, I think. And he did basically a 2 to 3 hour, you know, show with a break in the middle. And the first half, he talked quite a lot about 9/11. And, you know, he was basically talking about some of the things that I talked about in my book, in that we know, you know, we now know some of what happened on 9/11, particularly at the World Trade Center. You know, and I know you've had Dr. Judy on a few times, and we've spoken about that at some length. And Richard was also talking about that in his tour, and that was kind of the basis for what he was saying about 9/11, in that we've essentially now got to the point where, you know, we can prove pretty much what happened to the World Trade Center, and we know quite a lot about the sorts of or the nature of the technology that was involved in doing what was done. And, you know, when we go on from there, we can then document the effort to keep that knowledge covered up. And, you know, he went into quite some detail about two people that have popped onto the scene. Well, one's been on the scene for quite a long time. Ian Henshall, who's a UK guy whose parents apparently, or one of his parents, worked for MI5 or MI6, I forget which one. And Ian Henshall runs this website called Reinvestigate 9/11. And, you know, I've sort of challenged Ian Henshall as to why, you know, he's organized several public events about, you know, saying that the official story of 9/11 is untrue and all of this. But almost exclusively, he's talking about, you know, limited hangout topics. He won't discuss, for example, your KETAM case. He won't discuss Dr. Wood's KETAM case. He won't discuss Where Did the Towers Go, you know, the book. In fact, he won't really talk about any of those things. And I've basically asked him in several email messages, Ian, why aren't you talking about this scientific evidence, this scientifically analyzed evidence, which is...
Andrew, do you think he has a following? In other words, he's worth countering.
Well, I don't know how big his following is. He sends out these regular emails, which always make me sort of chuckle to myself. Because he's basically come back at me and said that I've attacked him, and of course, it's now that if you ask a question of these people, it's attacking them. I've just basically said to him, well, look, Ian, this is pretty well shown now. And I mean, you and I know that thousands of people have got Dr. Wood's book now. I mean, we are talking in the thousands now. And Ian Henshall has also written a couple of books about 9/11. And I won't spend too much time on this because, frankly, I don't think it's worth it. I don't think he has got a very big following, and I think he's probably, mm-hmm. He's probably trying to make out that he has. He's presenting this impression. And Ian Henshall has written two books about 9/11, and I think collectively they've got four reviews on Amazon. I think, and neither of which are
okay,
particularly
there's a good indicator.
Right. And of course, if you go on to Dr. Judy Wood's Amazon book page, I don't know how many reviews. I think there's 115 or something, last count, like that.
I think it was that whole thing turned into a food fight. There's over 1,000 entries.
Yeah, well, in the actual terms of the reviews, I think there's about 115.
Oh, okay.
But then if you go onto the comments on some of them, I think, Fetzer's review has got, like, as you say, about 1,000 or 2,000 or something comments on it. Oh, it's, oh, 6, yeah, 6,000 is somebody's, like Pete's saying there. I mean, that's just, it's just absolutely, I mean, that must be one of the most commented on reviews on the whole of the Amazon network. It must be. This is just, this shows you how important it is. It shows you how important this is and how hard they must work, to keep this covered up. And I think, to try and just spend a couple of minutes on this topic that I was mentioning in the email that I sent earlier today to you. We've had this this Niels Harriet fellow, the Danish chemist. Mm-hmm. He's recently been on this Red Ice Radio.
You've just posted an article that covers that and related on Red Ice. So tell us about that.
Yeah, did you get a chance to read the article at all?
I did read your article, yeah.
Oh, good, yeah. So you got the gist of sort of what's been going off.
Yeah.
And I think maybe, I've asked Pete there, I did send him the audio clip, and I think maybe if we were to set the scene, let's see, I'll just find out how long that audio clip is. I think it's like 2 or 3 minutes or something. We're going to be brazen and play this clip.
Okay, good.
It's actually 4 minutes long, so is that going to be okay with breaks and stuff if we go into this clip?
Are
we okay, Pete? I think we are.
We'll be fine, absolutely. I'm controlling the board.
Okay, so all right. So if you want to play that clip then, which is 4 minutes, this will kind of set the scene, I think, quite well for just this first discussion.
The truth will prevail.
Well, I hope you're right. I think so as well. It's we're all struggling and fighting to figure out what exactly has happened and how it occurred, the motives behind it. And although we do have a lot of pieces, and the pieces, in my view, primarily points to that something is not right with the official story, there are inconsistencies and everything. It's very difficult to determine exactly how things, came about, of course. And to going on from that, there's a lot of different theories out there. And one of them that I found also very interesting is some of the suggestions by Judy Wood, suggests that an exotic weapon technology was used to basically pulverize the buildings, a directed energy weapon, as she calls it. What do you make of some of those ideas, Niels?
What do you mean, directed energy weapon?
It's basically a new suggestion in terms of an exotic technology that has been, we don't know that either, but in development by some of the Black Ops weapon producers out there, DARPA, whatever call it what you will, that there's a new type of weapons technology that is largely unknown, but that was used on 9/11. You haven't heard about that theory.
Well, since it is basically unknown, it's very difficult to talk about, isn't it?
I'll send you some stuff on that. You can take a look at it. It's pretty interesting, actually. It's just some other suggestions in terms of why it would basically answer the question that you asked before. Why do it in such a way that it, you know, booms out like a mushroom, like in this way, like it turns into this immense dust cloud. And she has some potential answers for that. So it's very interesting.
No, she doesn't. Nobody knows what Judy Wood is talking about. I'm sorry. Nobody knows what she's talking about.
Why not?
Energy is not a thing. Energy is a concept we use in calculations. So if you want to discuss something, you have to be specific. Tell me, what is a directed energy weapon?
Well, she is the theory. I'm not behind it. I have her book. I look through the material, and it's some pretty interesting stuff there. Some suggestions, and that's all. And if you don't know about it, and if you want to find out about some possibilities, other ideas, I suggest looking into her work and following up on it on yourself and see if it answers some of these questions, you know, that we've been trying to answer here.
Okay.
All right.
I have no further comments.
Okay. Sure. No worries. All right. Well, is there anything else that, kind of big that we've left out? Something, you know, major in your work that you've been following, or in terms of your analysis or tidbits kind of along the way that are further inconsistencies that we haven't talked about, something to bring up?
No, not really. I think we have covered everything. Okay. Yeah.
All right. Very good. Well, thank you again for coming on, Niels. I really appreciate that.
Maybe as a last word, I would point your listeners' attention to the Consensus Project, 9/11 Project. If you go to www.consensus911.org, you will find a collection of evidence, which is the best evidence. It is evidence which has been really tested by a panel of 19 experts following a blindfolded method, which means that the conclusions coming out of it are reliable. So if anybody wants to get something which can be trusted, the best evidence available, I will direct them to consensus911.org, or just write the Consensus 9/11 Project in Google and you will find the webpage.
Very good. So yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, consensus911.org, please. Yeah.
Okay.
Hey, Andrew. They should call that website Crap 911. Consensus, you know, consensus just gives it away.
Right.
You just float downstream with the rest of the flotsam. You don't bother thinking, you know, that you can trust this.
Right. I mean, you know, this is sort of the typical sort of revamping of Scholars for 9/11 Truth. You know, they're trying to sort of stay in that line. Oh, you know, or it's all this sort of evidence you can trust. It's, you know, they'll say peer reviewed or something like that, you know. And, you know, you can just listen to that whole clip and it's just, I mean, it's just horrendous. And I think, you know, I knew what Harriet was about. I mean, I'd corresponded with the guy in 2008 and I'd said, you know, what about these, you know, upside down cars? What about this paper that's not burning and the car's, you know, inches away in flames? Wouldn't talk about it. He would not talk about this. And this guy's meant to be, you know, a PhD scientist. Now, I understand his PhD is either an honorary PhD or it's a made up PhD, as I understand it. Somebody wrote to me and said that he doesn't have, a full PhD.
I was thinking about asking you about his real credentials. So, right. Yeah, it sounds suspicious.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, that's sort of by the by, really, because we can, you know, we can just focus on what he actually said and his reaction.
Yes.
You know, and saying that energy is not a thing, you know, and all this nonsense.
Yeah, it's a concept. What did he say? A concept used in calculation.
That is
empty talk by an alleged scientist.
Right, right. Yeah. You know, and I mean, he's done that for several years now, and he seems to get away with it. And coincidentally, this Harriet guy, going back to this Ian Henschel guy, there was this, you know, TV license court case, which I posted an article about. And Harriet was actually called as a witness to this trial in the UK. You know, so he's had to come over from Denmark to a, he didn't get called into the court in the end, but he came over from Denmark, you know, to come to this court case. I mean, who's paying for this? You know, who's paying his airfare and whatnot? Yeah. You know, and I mean, people that were involved with this court case, one particular person I can think of called Tony Farrell, he personally knows me, and he knows, you know, that I've been involved with Dr. Wood's research. And, you know, she could have been called as a witness if he wanted. We could probably have sorted that out.
Yeah, and the judge wasn't allowing any of that. It's all beside the point for his failure to play his TV tax. You are listening to The Reynolds Reveal, and Andrew Johnson is speaking to us late at night in the UK, explaining recent developments in 9/11, and we're going to move on to some of his other interesting works, from chemtrails to crop circles to Apollo moon missions and Mars. Out of this world. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. We here at the Guerrilla Media Network do love to hear from listeners, and the number to call is 218-862-9829. I'm your host here at the Reynolds Reveal, Morgan Reynolds, and this afternoon we are speaking with Andrew Johnson from the UK, who is a fearless researcher on a number of topics. And the most important to me is 9/11. And Andrew, pick up again with the Red Ice Radio encounter you've had.
Right. Well, you know, we played that clip before the break, and, you know, people might want to go and replay it or something. I've got that in an article on my website, because this really,
which is checktheevidence.com.
Checktheevidence.com. Yeah, and you can go over to the right hand side, and it says recent postings, and you'll find a posting that I've made called Red Ice Radio Joins the Disinformation Promotion Brigade. Because I've seen this as a pattern. Now, you know, I must point out that Red Ice Radio, I've sort of listened to them for several years, and I was listening to them even before they invited me on as a guest in 2010. And I went on, I think, possibly even before Dr. Wood did. And so Dr. Wood went on and spoke about the, you know, where did the towers go? And it was actually the first time she went on was just around the time that the book was coming out. And so, because the book hadn't actually travelled across get delivered, you know, the books hadn't actually been fully printed and ready, she was kind enough to send Henrik Palmgren, the Red Eyes host, an electronic PDF copy so that he could review it before the interview. And he seemed, you know, perfectly happy with that and quite interested in it. And so, you know, and then later he was sent a printed version of the book. So he had all that information. I'd, for example, been on the program, and you can listen at least to the first hour for free, although they might take it off now when I sort of read to you what I'm going to read to you in a minute or two. But I went on there and basically went through the connection. And one of the key factors that we've come up with in the overall research is the connection between energy and 9/11, and one of the key figures in that is this Stephen E. Jones character, because we do know, you know, this is a fact, it's not a theory, just like everything else we're trying to talk about. He was involved in cold fusion research in the 1980s and early 90s, and that to me, you know, and he appears on the scene of 9/11 research in 2005, just after the NIST reports came out. And we've established, really, from looking at the evidence, that the energy effects that are seen in the evidence, this is Dr. Wood's research, not really my research as such, are important. And one of the things that comes up, for example, is tritium, because we've got this anomalous tritium reading in the water, which was sampled from around where the World Trade Center was after the events. And the tritium, I think, was 50 times higher than would be expected. So it's not like as high as what comes out of a nuclear reactor, which is, you know, 10,000 or 100,000 times above normal.
Yes, yes. But she addresses this in
the book.
Where do the towers go?
Right, yes. Right. And tritium was also one of the important characteristics that was seen in these cold fusion experiments. And not everyone that performed these experiments, you know, got the tritium. But people like John Bockris, who I understand was at the university that you were at, Morgan, Texas A&M, his team, they reproduced results which where they found tritium in their cold fusion or low energy nuclear reaction experiments that they did to sort of investigate what Pons and Fleischmann had investigated. So we can see this connection quite clearly in the evidence, and this is not a theory. There is a connection here. You know, we can't fully say, you know, how exactly that connection unfolds, what it means in terms of technology. But we can see that nuclear effects are involved in what happened to the World Trade Center. And I would contend quite clearly that that's why we've had all these stories about nukes coming out, you know, micro nukes, underground nukes, neutron bomb nukes, and all this nonsense that's come out since about 2005 or so, 2006. It's to cover up these nuclear effects, which are something to do with this thing called the Hutchinson effect. And I don't want to go into this here because we've got other things to talk about, but that's where we're going with this.
It all looks very much like a cover-up on multiple fronts.
Exactly. And now the red ice thing seems to be, unfortunately, another part of that, and I'll try and sort of qualify those remarks. You know, I mean, as I listened to Red Ice, I enjoyed the program. Henrik is a clever bloke. You know, he's done a lot of research. When you go and listen to it yourself, you know, heck, even subscribe if you want to. It's entirely up to you. If you listen to the way he talks to his guests, he's very knowledgeable. He asks informed questions. He thinks about things. He's been doing this since 2006, so that's 7 years. He knows a lot of stuff, you know. And so he knows, for example, that what's in Dr. Wood's book is not a theory. It's a set of evidence. He should know about the Keatam case. You know, you can't go to a court case with theory. You have to have the evidence.
Well, you know what my impression is, and I've only listened to your four-minute clip you've posted, is that it's like a person pleading for a hearing, trying to sound also reasonable and soft around the edges. But therefore he misstates things like Dr. Wood is making a suggestion or, you know, hinting at a new
right.
And all this stuff that's not the way to proceed. Let's get at the truth, no matter how inconvenient it may be.
Right. And I think, you know, when Red Ice listeners listen to that, they'll think that Henrik, you know, in fact, somebody wrote to me and said this. Oh, you know, Andrew, you know, you've got it wrong here because Henrik's actually championing, and actually wrote this on my Facebook page. Henrik is championing Judy Wood's information. You know, that's the word that he used, championing it. And I
yes.
said, you know, he's not doing that.
Jim Fetcher does. Too,
well,
right?
Exactly. It's no different to that. You know,
yeah, you're muddling it up is a term you've
exactly.
used.
Exactly, yeah, past. Muddling it up, you know, and mischaracterizing it. And you just, there is, not only there is there no need to do that, but by doing that, you're helping the cover-up. And then people wonder, well, is Henrik just not quite clued in? You know, is he just doing this because
yeah.
it's maybe because his first language is not English, you know, or something? Is it that, you know, or is it this? Or is it because he doesn't want to offend certain groups of his listeners and all this? And you can ask all these sorts of questions. And I ask
well,
those questions.
Well, you know what it also reminds me of is Stephen E. Jones, who's demeanor was so persuasive, just good propaganda. It's like the very lovely uncle, the grand uncle, and such a sweet guy. And the fact that he is he's leading you off into a dead end, a cul-de-sac, this escapes all too many people.
Right, and so, you know, you're getting into this warm and fuzzy glow, you know, and you're thinking in critical kind of. I suppose it's, you know, your skepticism is switched off or switched down a notch or more. And these things are slipped in so that you almost don't notice. And to me, when this happened with this interview, I didn't really want to listen to it because I knew what Neil Harris was like. His demeanor, as we were discussing, is rather unpleasant, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And it's like Henrik is offering up these remarks for Harrit to package up and kick into his goal, which is, you know, the one of disinformation. And, you know, Harrit's the chemist. He knows his stuff. He's the scientist. And so people are going to listen to this guy. Oh, go to 9/11 consensus, you know, as you said earlier. And so if it was just that program, you could almost say that Henrik was, you know, just being a bit dumb or not quite firing on all cylinders or whatever. But if you go and look at the guest list over the last few months, we've had several guests doing just what Niels Harrit did. We've had Mark Gaffney doing it. We've had Kevin Barrett doing it. And we've had this Jeremy Riss character who goes under this alien scientist pseudonym. They've had him on. And I've written articles.
So I see a pattern developing here. As you inform us, right? I mean,
right.
He's not asking you back or Dr. Wood or we'll call it a knowledgeable person about the Dr. Wood's work or the evidence at the World Trade Center.
Right, right. So, you know, we're getting these people offering these things up. And if all these Red Ice listeners are hearing all these people denigrating, you know, the research of Dr. Judy Wood or denigrating her character, and so forth, or saying that this book is just full of disinformation or whatever they say, then what are people going to end up thinking? So, I think just what we're going
well,
to...
Well, you know, part of it is they would be very satisfied with turning enough people off. Oh, they throw up their hands. People can't arrive at the real truth, and it's just... such a mess that I don't want to deal with it. So they don't even have to persuade anybody of a mistruth.
Right. And I mean, you know, what I actually wrote in this article, I put at the end that basically, I won't read it out verbatim, but I put 2 points at the end of this article where I'm, you know, covering the Henrik and Niels Harrit discussion. And at the end, I put basically, you know, that we know what happened at the World Trade Center. We don't have to consider it's a theory anymore. We know what happened. And when you understand that, there is no issue in the world that knowledge does not affect, right? And then I pointed out that I write all these articles, and I'm still at it six, seven years after I started, because it is the most important thing to understand.
We are all the beneficiaries of Andrew Johnson's work, especially on 9/11. And we're going to turn to some other topics Andrew's investigated, including Apollo and Mars missions. So return with us to the after the break. Here we are at the Reynolds Reveal. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And we here at the Guerrilla Media Network do welcome calls, especially first-timers, 218-862-9829. Excuse me. And this afternoon, we have from the United Kingdom, Andrew Johnson, who's delved deeply into a number of topics. And Andrew, I guess we're near the end of our coverage today on 9/11, but we haven't quite reached it. So, pick up that topic here.
Yeah, well, we're talking about this Red Ice radio thing, and we played this clip and so on. And really, essentially, what I wanted to try and do is illustrate the reaction that I got to that article that I posted, where I basically, all that I did was I reported the essence of what we played in that clip about Harrit and what Henrik said. And then I documented these other appearances by these, shall we call them, naysayers. Let's be, you know, slightly perhaps kinder than we might otherwise be.
and, your hysterical opponents.
Yeah, something like that. Yeah. And, you know, they've had some very strange takes on 9/11 being aired on this Red Ice Radio over the last few months. And so I wrote this article, which was my reasoned response, and trying to point out the importance of understanding what happened, you know, as Dr. Wood has been at pains to point out for the last few years, and rightly so. So I posted this article. I didn't send it to anybody at Red Eyes because I don't particularly draw attention to these things when I post them. It's not, I don't actually like posting them. I don't really like being in this situation where I have to post these things, but I feel there needs to be a documented record to, you know, set the record straight, because there's so many people bending the record and changing it that
I'm, yes, and I am, I'm so grateful for your work. I have the same qualms or difficulties.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you've done some of the same thing, haven't you? Because, I mean, I referenced a couple of your articles on this one that I've just done. But anyway, so anyway, what happened was, this article got posted, I think, yesterday or the day before, and then yesterday I got this email from somebody at Red Ice. It's not Henrik. It won't take people who know Red Ice long to work out who it is, but I won't mention them just at the minute. So their response to my article was, "Andrew, you should be ashamed of yourself for writing such garbage about Red Ice after all our years of hard work and dedication, and especially after we were nothing but kind and helpful to you. In turn, you behave as a fearful worm, trashing us behind our back, because you know the truth about 9/11. Well, how nice for you to be so certain. How enlightened you must be to determine what is theory and what is knowledge. Why are you so fearful to even listen to another person's point of view? Time and again we have said just because we interview someone, it does not mean we agree with them. In fact, we did Judy a favour by interviewing Niels. But you lack the capacity to even begin to understand that principle. You lack the capacity to understand what really occurred at the end of the of that interview. So if, for what if we interview someone you don't agree, who you don't agree with? Next time, we'll be sure to call you and ask first to see you if it is okay with you, Andrew, since you know the truth." So what Henrik called Judy's work a theory, because at the end of the day, it is to us. "Have you seen the energy weapon with your own eyes? Yet you become high-strung like a little neurotic puppy, peeing on the floor when something doesn't fit in line with your belief or threatens it. Most of life on this planet is speculation, ideas, theories. You lack the ability to be a rational human being, let alone kind to your fellow truth-seekers. Instead, you are quick to judge and slander. That speaks volumes about who you are." And this, now she quotes from my article, "I know I might sound too harsh or judgmental, but we do know what happened to the WTC now, so to characterise knowledge as theory is dishonest. Henrik should know better." That's what I wrote in my article, and she's quoting that. "Oh, so we all know what happened with all certainty. How? Huh? Wow, that arrogance. You do not even know Henrik, other than the kindness he showed you. And not to mention the years and years of his hard work, making it possible to interview researchers. In fact, Henrik was the first to interview Judy. Yet you, the enlightened one, trash a kind man you do not know personally, telling him who is disinfo and who is not. You accuse Henrik of being disinfo. You are so far gone while you accuse us of not being able to reason." And then she quotes from my article again. "Perhaps as far as Red Ice goes, this shows that being immersed in conspiracy culture affects your memory or your ability to reason, and you can end up not knowing up from down." And that's a question that I pose. "When I posted this on my Facebook page, people thought I was being unfair to Red Ice and Henrik." So I've already, you know, pointed out what she's already saying, that people would not like what I said, would say. "Of course people thought that, because you are being out of line completely, but you cannot even see yourself. You say immersed in conspiracy culture, after years and years of programs on a variety of topics, yet you yourself behave like a religious zealot in your remarks, gone beyond the point of being able to see up from down. Instead of being an arrogant truth fascist, telling other people what they should do or what they should think, look at your own self, Andrew. Learn to be a big man and let others make up their own minds and live their own lives. It is you who is spreading disinfo about a man and others who helped that man, who you do not know. Your words will have consequences." Sorry, just
Andrew,
one final thing.
The kind of letter that you should write and then crumple up and put in the round file. In other words, you feel better, but it's worthless. as omissive as anybody else.
The last statement is, your words will have consequences by your own doing. So anyway, I just briefly will, you know, I'll outline. I did respond to that message. You know, I could see just from reading a few words the sort of message it was going to be. But I basically asked them where they got this fearful worm idea. I never trashed anyone in the article. I did point out that Henrik was dishonest. I did say that, so I suppose that you could interpret that as I was trashing him. But I wasn't really trashing him. I was pointing out that it is dishonest to call theory evidence, because the two things, we have different words for those things because they are different things. So to characterise one thing as another is indeed dishonest. I mean, you know, it's just a statement of fact, really.
That's the way I would characterize it, is that you're pointing out, now Niels Harris is pushing poop, and you're stating a fact. This is right. Poop. It's provably false, and right. he arguably, I mean, he knows exactly what he is pushing. Right. And then Henrik knows better, but he didn't have the courage or integrity to counter what Niels Harris is saying.
Correct. I think what is also interesting, it wasn't Henrik who sent me this message, it was somebody else. And I didn't even reference this person in my article. You know, I referenced Red Ice Radio, and this person is associated with them. But I didn't, you know, I was actually quite complimentary to them in the first part of the article. And,
if Henrik were a kind man and a man of integrity, he wouldn't have ordered an underling to send this. He would be embarrassed and reprimanded.
Right.
And he really, if he knew about this, should send you, hey, I apologize, this was a mistake, and
to finish this off, and we've probably spent too much time on it, but I wanted to put it out there, because this is a sample of the kind of, you know, SH1T that we have to deal with. And unfortunately, you know, the way that this appears to other people, you know, you and I can sort of sit here at opposite sides of the Atlantic and discuss this rationally and go through it and break it down and analyze it. But some people don't do that. Some people will just see the verbiage and the bad language and the insults flying and just think, oh, you know, this is just a food fight. And I just think it's horrendous. These people just don't know how to behave. They're uncivilized, you know, whatever. And once somebody starts a fight or starts an attack, then when we rise to defend ourselves, that is also seen as a negative action. You know, we're cast in a bad light.
Yes.
You know, and we're accused of creating these fights, when actually we're just striving to show that when people are misrepresenting what has been said, you know, we're pointing that out. That's primarily what is being done. You know,
I also want to reemphasize this compliment I've given you earlier, and that is, from a historian and historian's point of view, it's great to have this record on the record to see how all of this evolved.
Right. Well, thank you. You know, and I appreciate that comment, because that's basically all that I've tried to do. And doing this stuff, it's just, I mean, I've tried to do it as a way of illustrating what psychology is at work, and I've tried to do it as kind of like, an observational thing where I'll send out these emails almost like a test. You know, it's like I'll try and put together a good sort of set of phrases that I've thought about carefully, and use that as a little mini experiment and see what comes back. You know. Without any sort of emotive language, and I'll be a bit sarcastic at times and stuff like that. But
you have a very good temperament. You're very measured.
Thanks.
Okay, you've accumulated what, at least 4 years, if not 5 years more of data, emails mostly.
Oh yeah.
For a follow up to your ebook, 9/11, Finding the Truth.
Mm. Mm, yeah.
Are you going to follow up with another?
Well, I've thought about it. I may sort of do a volume two, possibly, but I think I'd like to do it from perhaps illustrating some some of the aspects of psychology that seem to be at work. I mean, we're dealing with something which I would class as fundamentally evil here, and fundamentally, there's a guy called Tom Sheridan that put it quite well. He talks about, you know, psychopaths and so on, and he describes it as a predatory form of consciousness. And that appears to be what we're dealing with in all of this. There's some predatory form of consciousness which is working, you know, insidiously and sometimes openly, and we stumble across it in like that response I read out. I mean, that's just, some of it's just poisonous and goes way beyond, you know, what I would consider as appropriate.
Okay, we have to close the door at some point if we're going to cover some of these other interesting topics, and you're going to be able to address and give us some provocative ideas and evidence about. And so let's go to the Apollo moon missions. Hmm. And I wrote an article last August that it was triggered by this Curiosity rover lander. So we're going to talk, let's talk Apollo and then Mars. Now, the Apollo, well, I'm going to call it a hoax because it's demonstrably a hoax. Yet the public, these polls seem to show a residual majority that is pretty strong believers yet. And when I did this article exposing the Apollo 11 and the Apollo mission on the LouRockwell.com website, I never got so many emails. Half of them at least were negative, and not violently, but emotionally so. It was like I was attacking the whole the can-do, leading-edge American technology and engineering. You know, in other words, this belief in this is just seems to be relatively unshaken. So, where do you stand on this? What does the evidence show you?
Well, I mean, I'm sure that the thing is basically a hoax. I'm not sure of all the details of the hoax, but I know that. I know that those craft couldn't have landed on the moon, and what we were shown does not, in no way, proves that that actually happened. And I would also say that, you know, I put together a presentation about this, and I've given this a couple of times, you know, in public. And we did it on Richard Hall's show as well. We essentially sort of cut it down to, I think, an hour. And I actually got more email about that show than all the shows that we did about 9/11 combined. You know, I got more emails about the Apollo.
Interesting.
Yeah.
So it's not just kind of the American exceptionalism that is under assault. A lot of the Brits believe in the legitimacy of this Apollo mission too.
Absolutely. Hmm. And, you know, one, just to give you the two sort of ends of the stick, I suppose it. One guy wrote to me and he said, "Oh, you know, I can't remember the exact words, but he wouldn't." Accept the evidence that we'd presented, and he said, "I will continue to rejoice in the technical success and expertise that was, you know, embodied in the Apollo missions." It's something like that, and that was the end of our correspondence. And I wrote back to that basically when I finally accepted in myself that they didn't do it in the way that they showed us. I cried, you know, I basically wept to myself because I realized that I'd been scammed, and it was just I mean, you know, it was only a brief thing, but I kind of got over it because I'd already started to look into 9/11. It was kind of a cathartic, it was a cathartic moment for me. Mm. You know, the point being that, you know, we talked in the break a bit about that, you know, I mean, I'll be 49 in November. And so I was basically 4 years old when Armstrong allegedly walked on the moon, and when I was a kid, people would say to me, "Oh, what are you going to be when you grow up, Andrew?" And I'd say, "An astronaut." You know, so that's the effect it had on me. You know, and so mm-hmm. I ended up, you know, going into computer science and all this, and that to at least to some extent was influenced by my interest in space, science, Apollo, and all of that. So to come away years later and realize it was a hoax, you know, it was quite a cathartic moment for me.
What strikes you kind of in your top two or three that gives it away as a hoax. Oh, we're going to find the answer to that from Andrew Johnson in the UK after the break. You are listening to the Reynolds Reveal, so come on back and learn more about the Apollo mission. I'm going to stop at the time. How long I got to stay? Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds. And we here at the Guerrilla Media Network do welcome calls, 218-862-9829. That number again, 218-862-9829. And we have Andrew Johnson on the line in the UK. And we were, I just, before the break, asked Andrew what pieces of evidence come to mind as raising suspicions, if not outright refuting, the whole U.S. government story about landing a man on another heavenly body. Andrew, what really is gives this away?
Well, I think there are quite a few things which actually, when you think about them carefully, you realize certain impossibilities. And I think it's one of the things that's not discussed as often, occasionally it gets discussed, is the temperature issues. Now, you know, one of the things that was sent to me by a chap in Germany a few years ago, I think it's pretty irrefutable, really, as I see it. I would say it's irrefutable. If you go to a NASA website, you can download what's called the Lunar Rover Operations Vehicle Handbook, the LRV Handbook. And within that, it basically will tell you the specification for the battery system on this alleged lunar rover, and it gives you the upper survival limit of the lunar rover battery. It tells you the maximum temperature at which this thing would actually work.
So this would be like Apollo 15 or one of those follow-ons.
Apollo 16, yeah. I think, was the first one. I think 16. They used it on the 16 and okay. 17, I think.
Okay.
And I'll just try and get the figure. I've got it here. So in this Lunar Operations, Lunar Roving Vehicle Operations Handbook, Appendix A, it says that the survival upper limit for the battery system is 140 Fahrenheit, which is 60 degrees centigrade, right? So, okay. And then if you go to another website, which is an EDU website, an EDU website, I've got these links in the presentation that I've put together. It says, in the day, the temperature on the moon averages 107 degrees centigrade, although it rises as high as 123 centigrade. Mm-hmm. So we're way outside the operational range of this battery system. So, the how is this thing going to work? You know,
what they say is there's these dramatic swings because if you're in the sun, it's like 250 degrees Fahrenheit, this order of magnitude that you gave for centigrade, and then it'll swing down to minus 200 degrees Fahrenheit in the shade.
Right.
On the dark side, yes.
Right. And, of course, the same applies to the astronaut spacesuits. And also the other thing is the film in the cameras, because NASA, claim that the film in the cameras was not modified. But if you've got film at these sort of temperatures, it's going to melt. You know, it's going to deform. It's not going to have you're not going to be able to sort of get images off it without doing something extremely sophisticated to it. This is not going to work. And the other thing is that I point out is you go on a hot
those suits were made by Playtex.
Really, I didn't know that.
Doesn't inspire confidence. Yeah.
Gosh, I could come out with some jokes about the bras that lift and separate, I suppose, but maybe they just took those tactics into the 9/11 Truth Movement or something. I don't know.
You know, some of the this fascinating book I'm sure you're aware of, and you may know the authors, Mary Bennett and David S. Percy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Moon, Apollo, they go on and on. For example, you mentioned the camera, the Hasselblad.
Yeah.
How could it work at these temperatures?
Right, because I don't think they were very lightly modified cameras. They may have modified the case or something, but yeah. You know, and the other thing which I talk about is the, you park your car in a parking lot on a hot day, you know, and it's like 30 degrees, 25 degrees centigrade, or what, 100 Fahrenheit outside. You know, you go and get your things out of Walmart or whatever. You leave the car for half an hour. You come back. What's the first thing you do? You know, you either put the aircon on full blast, or you wind the windows down or whatever if you haven't got aircon.
Or both. Blow
or
it
both.
Out.
Whatever. Yeah. And, mm-hmm. and you're talking about half an hour in sunlight on the Earth. So how is this lunar module going to have air conditioning to make it habitable conditions for the astronauts when it's on the surface for, I don't know, 15, 20 hours, whatever it is? You know, they claim, the claim is that this thing runs on batteries. But Christ, how many sets of batteries are you going to need to take up to run this thing for that length of time?
And they had a very strict weight restriction. I can't remember, but it's kind of like a heavy automobile, like 4,000 pounds. And you can't have all these lead acid batteries in there. Wouldn't work.
Right.
Somebody, you know, when I was at Texas A&M, you're only 90 miles from Houston, and you go down to Clear Lake, I think, where the NASA headquarters and museum are. And one guy looked at that lunar lander, and of course it does look like a piece of junk and a piece of space junk, and he just started laughing when he saw it. And you see the size of it?
Yeah.
They can't even, in those space suits, they couldn't even get in and out of that doorway.
Well, this is something that Jim Collier did. Jim Collier was an investigative journalist, and he made a film called Was It Only a Paper Moon? You can download that film from my website. That was done in about 1990s sometime, maybe 97. He's dead now, Jim Collier. But exactly, he did exactly the thing that you're mentioning. They went to the lunar module mock-up, which I think is either at Houston or in the Smithsonian. If they've got, I think they might have another one there or something. But he measured the door, and he measured the size of the backpack, and he found that they could only just get through, and that there were these switches on the console. And if they'd, you know, it was very likely that if they'd bumped into these switches, they would have broken them off, you know. And that's something you can't risk in that sort of environment, you know, where you're going into a vacuum and so on. It's, you know, it's just crazy stuff. And so the physical aspects, when you start to investigate them, become very, very dubious, very dubious. And
there's another the psychology of this comes into play, because it's alleged that Neil Armstrong, you know, the first man to set foot on the moon, was something of a playboy before Apollo 11, which was July 22, 1969, if memory serves. And then after he came back, he was morose. He wasn't as near as sociable as he once upon a time was. He's now deceased. He died here, what, a year or two ago?
Less than a year ago, actually, he died.
Less than a year ago.
Yeah.
And when you look at who was the guy who made those series of films, but you see the film of the three astronauts in the auditorium.
Oh, yeah, the press
and
conference.
There's no elation. There's no joy in celebration of this great, you know, some people say the greatest technological achievement of mankind or humankind.
Right.
And so there's these psychological giveaways that it just doesn't seem to fit.
Well, I think we can get, that's a great sort of, you know, link to what I've sent to play. And we've got a clip, a very short clip, 34 seconds of Neil Armstrong speaking at the White House in 1994. So I don't know if that clip can be played. Just obviously got it's actually a video clip, but we're just listening to the audio from it, which is absolutely fine. And you can find this on YouTube, you know.
Well, Pete, can we
today
play that?
With us a group of students among America's best. To you, we say, we've only completed a beginning. We leave you much that is undone. There are great ideas undiscovered, breakthroughs available to those who can remove one of truth's protective layers.
So, you know, that's really one of the things that sealed it for me.
You know, Hollywood made that movie. I bought the DVD, Capricorn One.
Right, right.
Which was kind of a parody or,
I think it was a disclosure. I think it was a disclosure.
Maybe, yeah.
Yeah, that's the way I look at it.
There was talk, 2 or 3 years ago about making another Capricorn One. Where, of course, it's said that they faked a Mars landing. You know, they couldn't be quite literal and say they faked the moon landing.
Right.
But I haven't heard any more about that project.
Right. No, I've not heard anything about that.
Yeah. I'm sure the powers that be would have discouraged the makers. It's kind of like Oliver Stone making the movie JFK, and Lord knows what all obstacles he had to surmount to get that out in the public, and that's quite a great movie in terms of giving away the conspiracy to assassinate JFK.
Yeah. I mean, it does seem, you know, this is one of the things that I've come across in looking at all this stuff, that certain things seem to be being disclosed in movies, you know, in fictional movies. I mean, you know, and I do this talk about Mars, the Mars anomalies, which maybe we'll get some chance to come on to in a few minutes. And similarly, there's a film called Mission to Mars, which is from year 2000. And it's a pretty average sort of film. You know, you can watch it on a rainy afternoon and it's quite entertaining. And the sort of first sort of 7/8 of the film are pretty standard boring stuff. You know, where they take off from Earth, a mission crashes, another mission goes to rescue it, and it's and then somebody dies along the way and gives his life to save the others and this sort of thing. But then the ending, it's just like, whoa, you know, if you watch the ending to this film. But maybe we're skipping ahead in the story, because I wanted to go back to the Armstrong clip and point out what he actually said there. He's talking about removing Truth's protective layers. Now, why on the 25th anniversary of the moon landings would he be using such a phrase? And if you go and listen to that whole speech, which is not very long, I think it's only about 10, 12 minutes or something like that. At the beginning of the speech, he says... I can't remember the exact words, but it's basically he says, I've been told that a parrot is the only bird that can talk, but it doesn't fly very well. So I'm going to keep this short. And, you know, I have to wonder, I could be wrong, but I have to wonder if that's a reference to Gus Grissom, you know, Virgil Grissom, the astronaut who... was killed in the Apollo 1 fire along with the other two guys, Ed White, and I should remember the name of the other guy.
Roger Chaffee.
Right, Roger Chaffee. Yeah. And, you know, he if you go and research into Gus Grissom, you'll find that he was very, very unhappy with the state of the Apollo program, so much so that he organized a press conference to draw attention to the state of the program. And then there was an official inquiry, and the guy who wrote this report was then killed in a train crashing into his car, and his family were killed soon after this report was published. And of course Gus Grissom was killed, and his son Scott Grissom asked for an investigation and was able to determine that it looked like a plate was put into the capsule to deliberately start this fire, you know, and they flooded it with oxygen and so on.
Yes, 100% oxygen.
Right, right. So, you know, you've obviously looked at this as well. And so I wonder, you know, if Armstrong in this parrot thing was making a reference to Gus Grissom, you know, because Gus Grissom was starting to talk, but he didn't fly very well. In other words, he didn't fly in the Apollo mission because he was killed. It could be nothing to do with that. But it's a very strange thing for Armstrong to be saying. And I found out later when I was looking at an interview that Armstrong did with Ed Bradley, because Armstrong was notorious in that he gave very, very few public interviews. I think he only, I don't know, maybe he gave about 10 in, you know, 25 years or something like that. Probably less. And which is also very unusual. He should have been the most interviewed man on the planet, if you think about it. And he said in this Ed Bradley interview, it rolled out that Armstrong, his marriage of 38 years broke up in 1994, or 34 or 38 years. In other words, this was the same year he almost made this disclosure, as I see it, in that speech. His marriage broke up, so I think he was under enormous pressure then, and he wanted to disclose that this thing was, you know, was just a big scam. And And he said those words in the presence of President Clinton as well as in the presence of Collins and Armstrong, you know. And you can go and watch the clip and look at his body language. It's
He turned his life into a lie, a man of honor and, you know, patriotism and the like. And now, in a way, you could understand how a mistaken person of this ilk would. We're in a Cold War with the Soviet Big Bear, and this is a very thinly disguised national defense project, despite all the NASA pretensions to be transparent and a civilian show. So they go along with it, you know, kind of, it's a fateful step, kind of an irreversible participation in a crime. I call it a crime. I mean, a super fraud. And then he couldn't ever bring himself. But you're suggesting maybe at this point when his marriage broke up and maybe he was under stress and was despairing, he might have spilled the beans in public.
Well, I think if you look at that clip and you watch his body language, he was basically saying to these other guys, I'm really going to push the boat out here. You know, I'm really going to sort of push this as far as I can get away with.
I'm going to be right around along the ragged edge here. And even his phrase, repealing or pushing back truth's protective layers, makes sense in a way, you know, just as a purely scientific matter. Discovering the truth is often laborious and requires ingenuity and so on. But I'm thinking, hey, the landing on the moon, the Apollo projects were supposed to be all above board. There's you know, no mystery. Yet he's kind of saying this. He's indirectly suggesting this is a hoax.
Yeah. Well, I think he's saying more than that. I actually think he's saying there is hidden technology here, folks. That's what he's talking about. Great ideas, you know, to be discovered, you know, and this sort of thing. I mean, I think he's telling us a lot in those few words, to be quite honest, because of that. That's because of the other research that I've done. And, you know, the out of control black budget, you know, and these sorts of things have resulted in 9/11, you know.
It's kind of like Dwight D. Eisenhower's farewell address.
Very much like that.
You are listening to the Reynolds Reveal and my special guest, Andrew Johnson, a heck of a mind wandering over so many prominent issues and finding fault with the conventional story. Let's talk to Andrew Johnson of the UK some more on the other side of the break. Welcome back to the Reynolds Reveal. I'm your host, Morgan Reynolds, and if you would like to call in and speak with Andrew Johnson of the UK, you are invited to, and the number is 218-862-9829. Now, Andrew Johnson, we are down to our last segment of now less than 12 minutes, so let's be brave and go on to one more topic that you've investigated. Anomalies in the Mars evidence from NASA. What's going on with that? Did they, for example, did they really successfully land the Curiosity with 12 cameras aboard? I believe that. What do you say to that?
Yeah, well, I think that's a good opening question, really, because, you know, I've put together quite long presentations about this and stuff. And other people out there, I've got a good friend called Anthony Beckett who's also done quite a bit of research into this. And, you know, people have said to me quite recently, oh, Andrew, you know, you've said this Apollo is a hoax, so why, you know, can't you consider that the Mars rovers might be a hoax as well, you know? And it's a very good point, you know, because we've got to realise, particularly with 9/11, how the evidence can be manipulated, and when we've got no way, you know, like we can't verify anything that comes out of NASA. It's become more tightly controlled over the years. We can only verify, for example, what Mars looks like by looking at it through a basic telescope. You know, we can see certain elements on the surface, but it's very little compared to what NASA, you know, tells us that they can see. So we don't have any verification. So we should at least bear that in mind. And I do bear that in mind. My current thinking is that, yes, the rovers really are on Mars, but but if somebody, you know, comes along with evidence showing me that they might not be, I mean, somebody I've been talking to recently, if you look at some of the pictures from the Atacama Desert, which is apparently where they tested these rovers, or some of them, it's uncanny what the Atacama Desert looks like when you compare it to some of the Mars pictures that have come back from these rovers too. But I think it goes beyond that. And I've just clicked posted a link there for you to look at, Morgan, if you just want to bring that up. And it's just one picture. What I'd like, this is the one that I like to talk about, because not many people seem to be aware of this, and you can actually hopefully see this. It'll probably take a few seconds to appear. It's in the web archive for good reason.
With textured mound in central Sedalia Planitia.
Something like that,
Something like that.
In Latin, maybe.
Yeah.
Or something.
And in the small picture, it looked more like a golf ball in a kind of semi-natural cup or crater.
Right.
But it's a cratered with textured mound in the. So is this supposed to be on the planet Mars?
It is, yeah. And I've seen that. Okay. This is one of the newer pictures of this object, whatever it is. I mean, I'll say outright, I think that's an artificial structure. I'd say that is an artificial structure. Now, I can't prove that. We don't have any other supporting evidence. But to me, that looks.
You're saying
like
that cocoon bulge in the inside of this crater looks like an artificial structure.
I think it is. I think it's some type of geodesic dome. That's what I think is there. Uh-huh. Something like that. And I wrote to some geologists about this, and I basically asked them to explain it, and they wouldn't. But why I think this is important, you read out the captain, and that's very important. It's a textured mound. Now, mound, it does not necessarily mean artificial, but it's not exactly the same as saying a hill. Or, you know, they're acknowledging that it's not just a hill or a mountain or whatever. And that image, you can measure it. It's about 500 yards, I think, across that crater. So we know how big it is. We know where it is. And I'd just like to highlight a little example. In that I was talking about this with my brother because to me is an extremely arresting image. I find that image extremely interesting to look at, quite compelling to me. And so I use it as an avatar. You know, I post it on forums and on my eBay account and this sort of thing, in the hope that somebody will say to me, Andrew, what's that? What is that image? And one such person that did that was my brother, my elder brother. He asked me this probably a couple of years ago now. And so I said to him, oh, it's on Mars. And I said, I'll get you the link. So you'll notice that I sent you a link which is in the Internet Archive. You know, it's not the actual image that's on that page now. Because if I send you the actual image that's on that page now, which I'll paste now for you, you can click on that and look at it. And you'll see that it's essentially the same URL, but it's not in the web archive. This is the current live version of that image, supposedly the same image. You bring up that page, the design of the page you'll see has changed, the layout has changed. The caption is the same, but look at the picture.
Wait a minute. This it looks like a close-up in which it's disappeared just initially. It's not there.
It's not there. They've taken it off. Now, if you go to the links below, you know, I won't discuss that now, you can actually find this. You've got to hunt for it. But the fact that they've taken this off, and this is, you know, the University of Arizona website. We didn't say that in the discussion. This is directly on the University of Arizona website. I think in 2008 and 2009, they were showing quite prominently this headline image of this dome or mound or whatever you want to call it. But now it's not there. So to me, that's a cover-up. You know, I'm not going to put it more bluntly than that. You know, that I'm going to put it as bluntly as that. That is a cover-up. And in short, you know, I haven't got a lot of time, but I've seen them. Some of the rover images, for example, if you look at them, there's a chap called Sir Charles Schultz has done a lot of analysis independently. He seems to have discovered fossilized objects in these images, you know, several hundred of them from the 2004 rovers Spirit and Opportunity. And he's catalogued these, and he was invited by NASA to do a presentation about these fossils that he'd found, and then he was bounced off the list at the last minute, you know, and they won't talk to him. We've got the story of Gilbert Levin's experiment, which discovered microbes in 1976, and then NASA set out to debunk this experiment and say, no, it didn't discover microbes. It was actually a different type of chemical reaction. And they've sort of flip-flopped between announcing life and then saying, no, it's not there. And they've done it again, actually, with the Curiosity rover as well. And they've changed the colour of the sky in some images as well, because if you look at the original set of images that come from the Viking probes, the images show a blue sky. If you reprocess the red, green and blue components and so forth, you come out with a blue sky if you do your own processing in Photoshop or whatever. But NASA's images show a reddish sky, and they've continued to do this. And I think it's been proved by three different people that they have done a colour substitution and made the sky look red, when in reality the sky on Mars is blue. And that's something that I've covered in some detail in some of these presentations.
You know, I thought our sky looked blue because of our, we'll call it a thick atmosphere, compared to what they claim is on Mars, and they claim zero atmosphere on the moon. But the Mars atmosphere is supposedly only 1% of the density of ours. Yes. Mm-hmm. And what, you know, if we had, if we were on the moon, we would see stars brilliantly, unobstructed, and we would see pitch black space.
Right.
Just as you would in a, once you're free of, once cameras take, pictures of space, with a vehicle that's escaped our atmosphere and mostly our gravity. And now on Mars, I'm wondering, would it really be blue with such a thin atmosphere as alleged on Mars?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, certainly it shouldn't be red, because red actually implies a thicker atmosphere, really. Because if you think about the sunset, we know at the time of the sunset, the sky looks redder in the sunset because the sunlight is traveling through more of the atmosphere. So it's like, you know, the atmosphere is thicker for the sunlight because it's traveling through more of it. So you'd actually expect the reverse on Mars, that the thinner atmosphere would tend away from the red. You know, they'll claim that it's dust particles which are creating the redness, but that's not true, because the dust isn't constantly swirling in the atmosphere, else if it was, we wouldn't actually be able to see the structures such as the dome. You know, so the explanations are contradictory that NASA give out. But one of the killers is, if you study the calibration charts, which are actually on the Spirit and Opportunity rovers, they actually have these coloured panels on a little kind of gauge, which they use to colour calibrate the images. And you can clearly see that they've changed the colours of these if you study this. It's a clear, as Sir Charles Schultz puts it, it's premeditated lies. You know, you can prove this.
And then they've gone, as you pointed out, and perhaps Schultz did as well, that they've gone to black and white when we've got all this high-tech photography equipment.
Yeah, a lot of the images you'll see posted, they don't even bother to color process them. You know, they'll just leave them in black and white. You know, you're paying the Curiosity rover cost $1 billion. $1 billion for the Curiosity rover.
Well, let's really get crazy. What would they be covering up? Now, if you look at the dark moon, the authors Bennett and Percy believe that there was intelligent colonization on Mars, and there were, you know, these like artifacts that you're arguing, these structures that show intelligent life was there at one point. But the climate changed, and you know, Mars isn't in the sweet spot, of course, anymore.
No.
Earth is in the sweet spot.
Right. I think they're covering up the fact that the there is life elsewhere in the solar system, or there has been. That's what they're covering. The story of the solar system is much, much bigger than we've been told. That's what I think they're covering.
Okay. Fascinating. Andrew Johnson, what a fascinating guest and a mind expander. We need to think critically about every controversial area of life before we embrace any. I would think we're really close to the truth. Think for yourselves. That's the bottom line. So thank you so much, Andrew Johnson of the UK.
Thank you very much indeed.
Great stuff. This is the Reynolds Reveal. So come on back next week for another interesting show.